And I have indeed been to almost every single SSSA meeting since 1983, 33 years. And the Clark Lectureship, I think it started earlier than 2001. Does anyone remember? Well, like, when did it really start? But it was a long time ago, and looking at the group of people that have done it in the past, it's really a great honor to be doing it. And it used to be a longer program, right? So we used to have a main attraction and an undercard, and I was on the undercard once. And the last, and it was in 2000, right? So in 2000, we gave our talks, we went to watch the election results, and the world went crazy. So now the world went crazy last night, and now we give our talks. We survived that, and we will survive this. I'm confident and hopeful. So 33 years. I use this as an opportunity to think about 33 years of coming to this meeting and being a dedicated soil biology and biochemistry. I used to say I was an S3 guy, and I think most of you know what that still means. And boy, it's been exciting 33 years in our discipline. I mean, we have made enormous progress, and I started to think, well, if I asked a group of people what have we really accomplished since 1983 in soil biology and biochemistry, and this is the list that came to mind. I think the first thing most of us would say is that wow, we can open the black box of soil microbial communities. We couldn't do that in 1983. Our ability to quantify soil microbial process rates has improved. Our ability to extrapolate microbial process rates to scales relevant to questions in water and air quality has gotten a little better. We are deeply involved in understanding the role of soil biology, its responses to global environmental change, and then we're making progress evaluating soil biological interactions with other components of the biota and the abiotic environment and climate at different scales. So I would argue we've made progress in all these, and it's an impressive list. But I would argue the progress has been uneven, and that I think we've made more progress in some of these areas than in others. And this is kind of an order, right? And I think many of us, if we asked ourselves what have we made progress in, we would probably come up with this list, and probably in this same order. And so one of the things I want to do today is ask some questions about this, and the question about has our enthusiasm and excitement about opening the black box caused us perhaps to ignore other aspects of soil biology, process rates, scaling, interaction with other disciplines to address questions that are important in environmental science and in global change science. And we've been talking a lot in the Soil Science Society of America and in our different divisions about the relevance of soil science. This is a very exciting time in environmental science. Society is turning to us and asking us questions about the role of soils in responding to climate change or invasive species or a variety of land use changes. And we have an important role to play, but I'm going to try and make the point that if we spend too much time looking down and in, within the black box, it's going to inhibit our ability to address those questions. It's going to inhibit our ability to advance the importance of our discipline within the broader fields of environmental science, global change science, and then even this new emerging sustainability science. So I'm going to give some examples of thinking about looking up and out, as well as down and in, and thinking about how soil biology interacts with a variety of different organisms and processes and scales outside the domain of what we normally think of. I'm going to do basically three examples. So first, I'll talk about earthworms, right? We're all familiar with earthworms, and talk about how our perspective on earthworms has changed a little bit. I'm going to talk about plants as a driver of ecosystem response to environmental change, with the theme that plants respond more dynamically to environmental change than microbes do, and that therefore, when we really want to evaluate how ecosystems are changing and the importance of soil biology in that, we have to recognize that the plants are smarter than the microbes, and I'll try and make that case that plants rule, microbes drool, with a couple of examples. And then a little bit of work on denitrification. It's an old topic for us. It is a fairly miserable topic that many of us have struggled with, and I'm going to argue that struggle has made us stronger, and that indeed the things that we struggle with in denitrification, we struggle with in many areas of environmental science. And so I'm going to try and use that as an example of how looking up and out can help us address some of our traditional questions, but also help us to demonstrate our relevance in a broader arena of environmental and global change and sustainability science. So let's talk about earthworms. I have been working on earthworms since the mid-90s, and I have been lucky to work with a group of collaborators. We've had a faulty pointer, and we've had a really good group of faculty colleagues. We've had excellent students and postdocs, and we've been very lucky to have funding from the National Science Foundation Ecosystem Studies Program. So let's think conceptually a little bit, and this sets us up for the earthworms, but also for some of these other examples. You know, what are we about in S3 or in soil biology and biochemistry? Our wheelhouse, a centerpiece of our domain, is understanding the carbon and nitrogen flow through the soil food web as it influences organic matter accumulation and the cycling of nutrients and water quality and air quality. And we've been working on this idea of the importance of earthworms and also salamanders. Earthworms are big in the soil food web, and salamanders are an interface between the soil, below ground and above ground food web, and also a little bit on the effects on stabilization and loss of organic matter. So when we think about our discipline, we are having bad luck with the pointer. But we think about the flow of carbon from plants, above ground detritus and below ground detritus, flows into the soil food web, and most of it goes through the soil microbial biomass, and then it either ends up in soil organic matter or it ends up leaving the system in either gaseous or hydrologic pathways. And that's what we spend a lot of time on, this flow of carbon through these food webs. And thank you very much. Thank you. This is a fancy. Okay. So this is our wheelhouse. But we're also going to spend a little time talking about the flows through these interface predators, in particular salamanders, and then the link to the above ground food web. So we're going to talk about earthworms and the effects over here, and we're going to talk about salamanders and the effects over here. And this is kind of getting us to look up and out, right? We've been spending a lot of time wondering what's inside this box, and it's a very interesting area. But if we really want to get at some of these questions about where is carbon going and its regulation on organic matter and its loss to the atmosphere, we need to think maybe about some of these other groups. I'm going to try and demonstrate that. So our recent work on earthworms, we've been at this for a while, as I mentioned, but our recent studies, we've been doing a variety of different isotope studies, and I'll present some results from these now. So we have been comparing, we've been making C13 and N15 labeled sugar maple litter, and we've been applying this litter to plots that have no earthworms, plots that are dominated by Lumbricus rubellus, and plots that are dominated by Lumbricus terrestris. Now, these are exotic and invasive species, hideous invaders from another world that are changing our soils. Most of North America, the glaciated regions of North America, have no native earthworms, and many of our forest soils are characterized by thick organic horizons and a lack of earthworms. And in the last 30 years or so, there's been these invasions by these are European species who have been in North America for 100 years or so, but then there's also new species arriving all the time from Asia. And this is just a fundamental change in the soil community that has occurred. Really, people have paid attention to it over the last 30 years or so. So we've been applying litter, labeled litter, to these plots. We leave it out there for about 3 years, and we trace its movement into below ground pools, organic matter, and aggregates, and the fauna, and also into the interface food web with the salamanders. We've also done, to make this litter, we used these chambers that we expose small sugar maples to, and then we collect the litter, and that's really handy because it makes labeled roots, right? And so by moving litter around, we can have plots with labeled litter and unlabeled roots, and unlabeled litter and labeled roots, and labeled litter and labeled roots, and if you can keep all that straight, it's good. So we've been using those, and I'll talk about that a little bit. And we've also done some additions to trace hydrologic movement of N15 labeled nitrite and bromide as a hydrologic tracer as well. So here's the basic data. So this is we start with some litter that's got N15 in it. It has C13 in it. This is just 2 years of data. And in the absence of earthworms, at the end of 2 years, most of that isotope is still there. It's just sitting there. After 2 years, you've lost about 25% of the nitrogen and about 25% of the carbon, but in the presence of earthworms, you fundamentally change the way that carbon and nitrogen move from litter into the soil. So in the presence of Lumbricus terrestris, after 6 months, Most of the litter's gone, and anywhere in the presence of earthworms, the litter is basically gone after a year. All the isotope is gone after a year, both the N15 and the C13. Now, in environmental science, there's really a lot of interest in soil carbon. You know, we're trying to store soil carbon to keep it out of the atmosphere. We're trying to manage soil carbon to achieve a variety of ecosystem services. And you know, if the temperature goes up a little bit and the microbial population changes a little bit, you know, you can alter this line by, you know, like 10 or 20%. It's a big deal. But the earthworm effects are much bigger than any type of effect than we would ever see with climate or with many of the manipulations that we do. You know, we should be shouting about this a little more, right? Because this is a big change, fundamentally alters the way carbon and nitrogen move through the system. And it has an effect on soil carbon. So if we look at soil carbon pools down, only down to about 20 centimeters, but in plots that don't have earthworms, compared to these plots dominated by Lumbricus rubellus and Lumbricus terrestris, you lose almost half the soil carbon is gone in these plots after about 20 years of invasion. The effects are not as marked with terrestrials, but again, this is a huge loss of soil carbon. We're interested in understanding soil carbon and managing soil carbon to achieve environmental objectives. Earthworms are really having a very marked effect on that. So we lose a lot of carbon. Interestingly, we don't lose as much nitrogen. So if we see it actually the effects in the terrestrials, they're not significant, and they're significant in rubellus, but it's not nearly as marked as the carbon effect. So we've lost a lot of carbon. Earthworms are causing us to lose carbon, but they're also stimulating nitrogen retention in some way. They're lowering the C to N ratio in the soil, which has a huge effect on nutrient cycling processes, it creates kind of a little bit of a mystery. How are we losing carbon but retaining nitrogen? We think that earthworms are increasing the soil carrying capacity for microbial biomass. So if I look at just the total pool of microbial biomass N, in the presence of earthworms, there's a lot more nitrogen just sitting there in the microbial biomass. We've moved the microbial biomass. It used to live in the forest floor. It now is mixed into the mineral soil, probably a better habitat for microbes. And we would argue that earthworm mixing is increasing the size of the microbial biomass and likely increasing the flow of carbon and in particular nitrogen from the litter through the microbial biomass and into stable pools in soil organic matter. So this is clearly an earthworm effect on the microbial biomass that has big effects on both carbon and nitrogen. We think a lot of that nitrogen retention is driven by the movement of nitrogen from the light fraction into aggregates, and so we've studied the movement of isotope into the aggregates, and so we have these plots that where the roots are labeled, and we have root labeled plots without earthworms and with earthworms, and the absence of earthworms, as many of us have seen, there's a lot of isotope in the light fraction, but boy, that's gone if you get roots in there, and that they are really chewing up that light fraction. And we would argue that they're moving a lot of that into the microbial biomass and into these macro aggregates and micro aggregates, and that could be the site of the stabilization of this carbon and nitrogen. So this is interesting for us because it's a basic soil biological question. We all studied earthworms from the beginning. We know that they influence carbon and nitrogen. The challenge is can we produce information that is relevant to these societal questions about carbon and nitrogen flux and the atmosphere. And in order to do that, we have to do these ecosystem scale experiments and then trace these isotopes and get the mechanistic information we need. This nitrogen mystery, right? So we think that the earthworms, they make a bigger microbial biomass, and that microbial biomass shunts a lot of nitrogen into organic matter. The earthworms also appear to reduce the flow of nitrogen towards loss pathways. So this is sampling over many years. Plots without earthworms have higher nitrification rates than plots with earthworms. And if you can reduce nitrification, then you're going to reduce leaching losses and you're going to reduce gaseous losses as well. So this reduction in losses is also contributing to the stabilization or the retention of nitrogen, even in these plots where the carbon has been dramatically lost. So we were interested in these loss pathways because we had expected that earthworms would greatly accelerate nitrogen loss through the systems. We kind of expect that earthworms will accelerate the movement of water through systems and therefore increase leaching losses. But maybe not so in forests. So we did this work where we applied bromide, right? So this is bromide. We applied bromide to the soil surface. We applied it in the fall. We had a series of plots with fall additions and a series of plots with spring additions. And then we traced its movement through the soil profile with lysimeters. And so in these fall additions, it turned out just like you'd expect. So you apply the bromide here, and then in plots with earthworms, it shows up sooner and it shows up at higher concentrations, kind of the expected effect that earthworms are accelerating the movement of nitrogen through the soil. But in the spring addition, it's not the case. So in the spring addition, we apply bromide to a similar plot, you know, similar different set of plots, but in the same site, and the bromide comes out sooner and in higher concentrations in the absence of earthworms. So at least during part of the year, earthworms actually appear to be retarding the movement of water through the soil. Now, that would be a surprise in agricultural soils, where earthworms, we know they make big macropores which facilitate movement through the soil. But, you know, what's the bulk density of a forest soil? You know, it's 0.3. And there's already a tremendous amount of macroporosity in a soil like that. And so the earthworm effect on the movement of water is actually quite a bit different than we in forests than we expect in agricultural soils. So we added bromide. We also added N15, right? So here's the N15 in the leachate. And again, here's in the fall edition. And again, you know, there's really no clear signal. The earthworms are not accelerating the movement of N15 through the soil profile. In the spring edition, the earthworms are significantly decreasing or retarding the movement of N15 through the soil profile. It comes out in the earthworm plots. It comes out later, and it comes out at lower concentrations. And so this, I think, has shed some light on the surprising effects of earthworms on retention of nitrogen and loss of nitrogen. It meant we had to deal with soil physics. You know, I didn't want to do that. I mean, so I got lysimeters out here. I have hydrologic tracers. But if we want to be able to put these earthworm, which is a basic soil biology topic, if we want to put it in a broader context, we have to look up and out and talk to the soil physicist, which is fun always. Okay, so let's go back to this diagram here. Okay, so we learned a little bit about this is a common flow through the soil food web, in through the microbial biomass. I mean, there's lots of people that are interested in this. You could go to the National Center for Atmospheric Research, and they're running big models. These models where you shake the table when the model runs. You know, it's a big model, and they're modeling the movement of soil carbon and nitrogen through the soil webs. They don't know anything about earthworms, and earthworms are a fundamental controller of that. And it's up to us to make them aware, and provide the data that they need to make those models better. The other thing that people aren't thinking about is the movement of carbon and nitrogen up through from the below-ground food web into the above-ground food web through interface predators like salamanders or ground-nesting birds that feed on soil fauna and then inject that carbon and nitrogen into the above-ground food web. So here's our labeled litter studies. Again, this is the graph I've already showed you. N15 remaining in the litter over 2 years, C13 remaining in the litter over 2 years. So I have earthworms in these plots, and they're really changing the behavior of the litter. So in these same plots, we have lots of salamanders. And salamanders actually are the biggest biomass of vertebrate in these forests in the Northeast, bigger than the deer or bears or like a crumple-horned snorkax. There are really a lot of salamanders out there. And so we cut the tails off of them, and you can analyze the isotope content of the tails. And you can see, do the earthworms influence the flow of carbon and nitrogen to the salamanders? So it's a little bit hard to see, but if you look at the first, after 6 months, the salamanders are really benefiting from the presence of earthworms, because the earthworms have mobilized carbon and nitrogen from the litter, and the salamanders are much more enriched in the presence of earthworms than in the reference plots. But that fades, because you can see by the time a year rolls around, all the carbon and all the nitrogen are gone. They're below ground, and the salamanders can't get it. So over this is actually a 3 year with the salamanders, there's a vast amount of carbon and nitrogen that flows through the salamanders and then up the food web in the absence of earthworms. But in the presence of earthworms, you've completely redirected this flow of carbon and nitrogen elsewhere within the below ground food web and away from the above ground food web. And so to the extent that there's a flow of energy that supports biodiversity in the above ground food web, that's lost in the earthworm invasion. And that's it's a fundamental effect, and it's something that's of interest to us but it's also of interest outside our discipline. One other thing, kind of unexplored in earthworms, which will segue into plants, is earthworms eat roots. And I don't think we spend enough time thinking about the fact that earthworms eat roots. So here is these labeling chambers where we produce labeled roots, and you see here are the roots, and the roots are pretty highly labeled. And then here's the rhizosphere soil, which was harder to sample. And then here's some earthworms, right? And so you look, the roots are labeled up between 75 and 100 per mil in C13, and so are these earthworms. These earthworms eating detritus kind of strongly suggest that the earthworms are eating roots. And we hadn't really thought about that. And what effect is that going to have on competition between different tree species, the performance of tree species under altered environmental conditions? We really hadn't thought about earthworm-root interactions before, but these data from the isotope studies suggest we should be thinking about that a little bit. So, earthworms, it's an old topic in soil biology, but in terms of a broader spectrum in environmental science, earthworms are changing across North America. These European species are colonizing areas where they weren't before. We have new species arriving from Asia and also from other places in Europe all the time. And so we have this fundamental change that's going on in soils that's fundamentally altering decomposition and the flow of carbon and nitrogen in ecosystems. And we're interested in that, but we should be shouting and making the case that this needs to be considered in other areas of environmental science that are interested in the flow of carbon and nitrogen in ecosystems. It's also important on biodiversity. We're very interested in biodiversity at multiple levels in these ecosystems, and earthworms fundamentally affect that. And what about the rest of the fauna? Earthworms are easy to study. Nobody wants to study nematodes, mites, and isopods, except for Diana Wall, and she's famous because she's willing to do that. But I think if we can make the case that when we alter the soil fauna, we get really important effects, and it's not as sexy as extracting DNA and looking at the microbial community composition, but it might be just as important, and we want to make sure we don't neglect it. Okay, I'm going to move on to my next example of why it's fun and useful to look up and out, with a series of studies about plant microbial interactions and how they plant microbial interactions influence ecosystem response to environmental change. And I've got one example that I'll talk about in a little bit of detail, and then a couple of others really shortly, in less detail. So I've been very lucky to work at the Hubbard Brook Long-Term Ecological Research Site in the White Mountains of New Hampshire. The Forest Service maintains this site, and they have collected long-term data records that are just an incredible platform for addressing questions about the importance of soil biology in ecosystem processes. We've been focusing quite a bit on winter processes, and one of the marked changes that's occurred, this is a data record going back to 55, is changes in snow. So there's less, the snowpack is not as deep, the water content of the snowpack is not as high, and the days of snow cover have gone down. These have kind of gone down significantly over this 50-year record. And a lack of snow has a huge effect on soil processes. In particular, a lack of snow will cause the soil to freeze. All right, so here's a picture of Hubbard Brook in February of 2006. There ought to be 70 or 100 centimeters of snow on the ground. Instead, there isn't any. The soil is frozen hard. Even the stream here is frozen hard. And this represents a fundamental state change. These northern soils, they're not supposed to have earthworms, and they're not supposed to freeze. Right? We know that when they're covered with soil, the soil insulates them, and they don't freeze. And this is a huge and understudied aspect of climate change. So we started studying this back in the 90s with very sophisticated manipulation involving shoveling snow out of the woods, and it worked, actually. So we did, these are 10-meter by 10-meter plots, and you can see the temperature in these plots. This is the fall, it goes into the winter, and you can see these are reference plots that are covered with snow, and they never freeze. They stay right at around 1 or 2 degrees C, and the shovel plots are colder and quite a bit more variable because you've lost that insulating blanket. And this manipulation does create this really kind of fundamental change in winter climate in the soil. But it's interesting, it doesn't get that cold, right? So you can look, these temperatures here aren't really that cold, really not cold enough to, to really disrupt soil processes, or so we thought. And so this experiment ends up being a pretty good analog for future climates, where it's going to be less snow, but it's not going to be that cold, so the soils are going to be different, but is it enough to matter? So in these plots, we had huge increases in the loss of nitrogen and phosphorus from these plots. So these are lysimeters, again, lysimeters, which really are not fun to work with. But we have nitrate and we have phosphorus, so these were frozen in the winter. The following growing season, nitrate came pouring out the bottom. We did this 2 years in a row, again, nitrate, and we see the same thing for phosphorus coming out the bottom. So there was a real market disruption of the nutrient cycle caused by this soil freezing manipulation. Now, we knew that this was going to be driven by changes in microbial biomass and activity. We expected that since you've frozen the soil, you were going to maybe kill some microbial biomass, you were going to alter plant microbial interactions, and the idea was that we would see big changes in microbial biomass and activity. But we didn't see it, right? So we measured microbial biomass, carbon and nitrogen, and some activity rates. The table's a little busy, but you'll notice there's no shining stars or superscripts. Microbial biomass carbon didn't change, nitrogen didn't change, mineralization rates didn't change, net nitrification rates didn't change, nothing. No change in the microbial biomass or activity. These are lab measurements. We also did in situ rates of mineralization and nitrification with buried bags. You see mineralization over 2 years, no treatment effect, nitrification, no treatment effect. So this was a surprise, right? So we got a big increase, a big disruption to the nutrient cycling, but the microbes were just kind of solidly kind of going along, doing what they were doing, not responding to the treatment. And the treatment response was all about roots. So while the microbes weren't affected by this, the roots were. And we had a doubling of overwinter root mortality. I don't know if you've ever thought about what it's like to be a root in the forest in the winter. About 15% of those roots die over winter. And in the presence of this freezing treatment, it doubled, right, to about 30% died. And again, in 2 years. And so if you kill roots, you're going to have less root biomass, you're going to have less root uptake. And it looked like the increase in nutrient loss that we got from these systems was driven almost entirely by a change in microbial biomass. And it started us thinking on the idea that maybe if we want to study the ecosystem response, the really we need to focus on what the plants are doing and how the plants are responding to the environmental change, and that the microbes might just be kind of dumb black box bioreactors in the dirt, just kind of chugging along, you know, at important rates, but not responding very dynamically to the environment. So that's what emerged from these studies. Now we kept at this. We did a couple of rounds of this. Shoveling snow out of the woods, and we began to get concerned that the funding agency was not going to continue to pay us to shovel snow out of the woods. So we shifted and we applied an elevation gradient study, and we were worried that the shoveling was a bit of an extreme manipulation. So at Howard Brook, there's about 500 meters of elevation that gives you about a 2°C variation in mean annual temperature. So it's warmer down at the bottom of the hill and colder at the top of the hill, and the variation is about 2°C, which is really a nice analog for climate change. And we have really very little variation in soils or vegetation along this gradient. And so it's a nice analog for climate change, a good companion to the plot studies, something that takes us to look up and out, right? So again, with these studies, we could, you know, there was a tremendous temptation to say, let's drill down and understand really what's going on within that microbial pool and how is it changing or not changing in response to the death of roots. But if we wanted to address the importance of those dynamics in an ecosystem context relevant to global climate change, we needed to look out, up and out, and not just down and in. And the elevation gradient study, I think, illustrates that pretty well. Now, the other advantage of the elevation gradient study is it's a long-term change, right? So the shoveling is a short-term response to a disturbance, whereas these plots have been exposed to altered climate for hundreds, thousands of years, and so the effects are easier to see. So here we're measuring in situ net mineralization, and we're comparing the high elevation and the low elevation, and indeed mineralization is always higher, nitrification is always higher at the high elevation plots. It's colder, but there's more snow. And so the lower elevation plots, they have more soil freezing, seems to damage the microbial communities associated with nitrification and mineralization. And so in the elevation gradient, which is a longer term change, we do see that the lack of snow appears to reduce the overwinter nitrogen supply, with effects that carry over into the summer. And it looks like variation in winter climate is actually very important for nitrogen supply to these systems. We still think, though, that that is all about roots. And so in recent studies, Pat Sorensen, a graduate student, was looking at the relationships between roots, snow, and nitrification in these plots using exclusion cores, so root ingrowth cores and root exclusion cores, and seeing how nitrification varies along our snow gradient. So we have a nice gradient of snow, and you can see there is more nitrification where there's more snow, but the effect is much more marked in the absence of roots. And so you could easily imagine that if I damage the roots with soil freezing, I'm going to have less roots, and I'm going to have much less control over nitrification, and I'm going to have much more nutrient loss. And so we kind of dug into these root microbial interactions, and indeed the microbes are affected by the long-term climate variation, but their response to that climate is still mediated by the interaction with the roots. So what have we learned from our studies of winter climate change? We saw that winter climate change is fundamentally disrupting nutrient cycling in these forest soils. And we know that soil biology is super important to the cycling of nitrogen and phosphorus and calcium and magnesium, but we're not seeing any change in microbial biomass. We're not seeing much of a change in microbial activity. Rather, the plant response appears to be controlling the ecosystem response to this disturbance. And so if we really want to understand the importance of soil biology and ecosystem response to climate change or other disturbance, we really need to think about plant microbial interactions. And maybe we can, in some cases, treat the microbes just as these kind of dumb black box bioreactors churning along in the dirt, but we need to focus more on how they're affected by plants. And I'm kind of poking us with this, and we can argue about this a little bit later. And why might the plants be more exciting? Well, they have access to the atmosphere. They have access to the soil. They have a lot more genes. They do a lot more things. Plants do respond more dynamically to environmental change because they're just more sophisticated than some of our microbial friends. A couple of other examples from our work at Hubbard Brook along this idea of plant microbial interactions. In 1998, we had an ice storm. Knocked out about 30% of the leaf area in the forest, and there was a huge increase in nitrate export from the watershed. Nitrogen came pouring out of these watersheds. And we went out, and again, we predicted that this increase in nitrate export was going to be driven by increases in mineralization or nitrification, especially in these gaps, these ice storm-created gaps where the soil was wet, the soil was warm, and we expected high rates of mineralization and nitrification. But we didn't see it. No, we measured in-situ rates, we measured net rates in the lab, we measured growth rates, and none of them responded. Again, the microbes were just plugging along, but they weren't responding to the change in the environmental conditions. Whereas we assumed, we said, well, if we've lost 30% of the leaf area, then we've probably lost 30% of the N uptake by the trees. That's a lot. That would easily account for the increase in export at the weir. And so again, our conclusion was, well, the watershed ecosystem response is driven by the plants and not by the microbes. And so then Tim Fahey, one of our colleagues, said, well, if it's really the plants, then once the leaf area comes back, and which should take 2 or 3 years, then the watershed export should return to normal. And that's exactly what happened. And so it was really very much you damage the trees, you damage the plant uptake, and that controlled the watershed ecosystem effect. Another experiment we did at Hubbard Brook, this is an area that was damaged by acid rain, about 50 years of acidic deposition. These are inherently base poor soils. So we added 850 kilograms of calcium per hectare to a whole watershed to replace the calcium that had been lost by acid rain. And we had strong predictions that microbial biomass and activity, which we know are sensitive to pH, were going to increase. I had the easiest part of this project, that we're putting on calcium, and I knew that nitrification especially was going to go up. But instead, everything went down. Microbial biomass N declined, pools of inorganic N declined, mineralization rates declined in the treated watersheds. there was less nitrogen flowing through the microbial biome, as several measures showed us that. At the same time, the plants were really responding markedly to the calcium addition. Symptoms of sugar maple decline were reversed. We saw marked increases in mycorrhizal colonization of sugar maples. And we had the simple realization that the plants were able to respond to this calcium addition much more dynamically than the microbes were. And so the plant vigor increased, and they were able to outcompete the microbes for nitrogen, and so less nitrogen was moving through the microbial biomass. And again, you know, if you give plants a soil resource, they also have access to the atmosphere. And so they can use that soil resource to change their interaction with the atmosphere. And then they could use their interaction with the atmosphere to change the way they exploit resources in the soil, and the microbes can't do that. So there's this idea that these are fundamental questions in soil biology, and they're fundamental questions of interest in broader environmental science and global change science. I think if we really want to study the importance of soil biology in these, we've got to look up and out a little bit and think about how do microbes interact with plants. We need to apply study those interactions in the context of whole ecosystem experiments. If we're really gonna, I think it helps us learn about soil biology, and I also think it helps us to contribute to these broader scientific efforts. Okay, so my last example goes back to denitrification. And this is Madhura Kulkarni, was a graduate student at Cornell, and she did her work at Hubbard Brook. And she is looking down. But her research was, she was trying to figure out how much denitrification was going on in these whole watersheds at Hubbard Brook, and indeed in the whole region in the Northeast. And this picture that she made, to me, illustrates one of the great exciting challenges in soil biology. We're making measurements on small scales. And yet people really want the data at relatively large scales. And so the great challenge we have is going up from these small scale measurements to the large scale. And it's important for us if we're interested in these processes, but it's really important if we want to provide data that's relevant in environmental and global change science. So just to remind everyone about denitrification, we start with nitrate and nitrite, and we reduce it to these nitrogen gases. That's an anaerobic, facultative anaerobes, mostly heterotrophs, that carry this process out. And it's a process we have been studying since the 1880s. And at first it was bad, because it was nitrate was a limiting nutrient, and so denitrification was bad because it was reducing soil fertility. But then once nitrate became a pollutant, denitrification was good, right? Because it was getting rid of this bad water pollutant. But now it's bad again. Because it's producing nitrous oxide, which is a greenhouse gas, and NO is so this is just a great process, right? Because you can just keep studying this process, and people really want to know about it. And yet we seem to learn very little. Progress in denitrification has been difficult because there are some methodological problems. And indeed, we wonder why is this still such a miserable process to study. We have method problems. We're trying to measure the flux of N2 out of the soil, and the atmospheric background is N2. It is the world's greatest contamination problem, and that has led us down a series of unsavory paths with methods that alter soil conditions, and we worry that the results that we produce are a function of the method that we used. Process really varies a lot. You know, it's controlled by oxygen, it's controlled by carbon, it's controlled by nitrogen. Each of those have a significant variation structure. You multiply those together, and you get really a hideous variation in time and space. Activity dominated by small areas with high flux and small periods of time with high fluxes. And then we have the scaling problem, right? So people really want to know how much denitrification is going on in a crop field or in a landscape or in a whole region, right? And I can't even measure it at the plot scale. So we want to take a bad number, poorly constrained because of variation, and we want to multiply it by a big number, right? So what do you get if you take a bad number and multiply it by a big number? Is it a really bad number or a big bad number? But this is the challenge that we face in denitrification, which, again, I would argue makes us stronger. I would also argue that this is the challenge that's common across environmental science. And I'm trying to make the case that the things that we learn about denitrification are relevant in many areas of environmental science. And across the fields of environmental science or sustainability science or global change science, we're all struggling with methods, we're struggling with variation, we're struggling with scaling. And I think that this is just a real platform for us to engage with a broader group of people. And with denitrification, the demand or the need for information on denitrification has never been greater. So this was the big motivator for Madura's work. These are pretty large-scale watersheds in the Northeast. They all should be colored in blue, except for Pennsylvania. And they made these pretty detailed input-output balances for these, where they did all the inputs and they did all the outputs, including estimates of denitrification in the river. But still, 40% of the nitrogen was unaccounted for. And these were pretty detailed budgets. And this is a fundamental challenge that we face. We're trying to manage this region. We're trying to protect, to minimize the delivery of nitrogen to these coastal waters. We're trying to manage urbanization and sewage treatment plants and agriculture and atmospheric deposition, all of which are changing. This is just a fundamental environmental problem in this region. And as long as 40% of the nitrogen is missing, we can't really address that problem. And so this really motivated us to continue to try and produce denitrification at this scale. Now, Hubbard Brook is a wonderful place to make progress on denitrification because there's a long-term record of nitrate export. So starting in the 60s, they were measuring nitrate export from these forested watersheds at Hubbard Brook. The exports were high in the 70s and the 80s. They declined into the 90s, and they've continued to decline, which is a little bit of a surprise, right? Because the forests at Hubbard Brook are old, right? And so when the forest is young and actively growing, it's a sink for nitrogen. But when it's kind of stable, you don't have any extra nitrogen being socked away in the trees. So there's an expectation that these nitrate concentrations should be going up as the forest ages. You also, this is atmospheric deposition, is pretty high and pretty stable over this record. It started to decline in recent years, but over the course of this decline, you had a lot of nitrogen coming in from the atmosphere, coming into old forests. We kept expecting the nitrate concentrations to go up, and they kept going down over time. And so this is a good place to study denitrification for a couple reasons. One is because you have very well-constrained watershed nitrogen budgets. So it is a place to really, you know what the other fluxes are, so you could make some measurements of denitrification and have some way of determining if they're realistic. But also, if it's declining, perhaps that's due to denitrification. Maybe denitrification is going up and is causing this decline in nitrogen. Another postdoc, Jen Morse, she took this up, and we had some improved methods. So we've developed some improved methods that allow us to directly measure the flux of N2 and N2O, still in extracted soil cores, but we're not using isotopes, or we're not using inhibitors, and with higher sensitivity. And so she was able to estimate that about 4 kilos of N per hectare per year is being denitrified in these forests. These are upland forests at Hubbard Brook, and that is really the amount of missing N, the amount of decline over time, is around 4.5. So it appears that denitrification is really quite important at Hubbard Brook, and is certainly very large relative to the missing N. But again, the question is, in order for denitrification to be accounting for this decline, it has to have been going up over this period of time. So we're able to determine that, yes, denitrification is important, but is it going up over time? And we have reason to hypothesize that it might be. It rains more, 20% more in the Northeast than it used to, so the soil is wetter. As I've already talked about, we've had changes in winter climate, where we have a susceptibility to nitrogen losses at snowmelt and at the spring-winter transition. We're having more rain coming in big events, and so drying and wetting events are important. And we're also looking at, because of these increases in moisture, changes deep in the soil profile. So the work at Hubbard Brook allows us to test a whole series of hypotheses about this process. So we have new methods. We quantified the process, and we're able to now look and see maybe it's increasing in response to environmental change. So some of the work, and again, this is led by Jen Morse, was we have these new oxygen microelectrodes, which allow us to study, ask this question of, do rainfall events cause reduced oxygen in the forest floor? So upland soils, maybe there's a hot moment of denitrification once it rains. So we install these microelectrodes in the soil. These are fantastic. They're about $800 each, and if you sneeze on them, they break. So it's a stressful. But anyway, so you dump 3 centimeters of water on them, and there's no change in oxygen at all. 3 centimeters is a pretty good bit of water, but it doesn't have any effect on oxygen. You can dump, then we said, well, let's dump more water on, and we dumped 6 centimeters of water on there, nothing. Had no effect on oxygen. But if you dump 6 centimeters of water with a little glucose in there, boom, the oxygen immediately goes to nothing, right? So if you create a little respiration sink for nitrogen, then you can get markedly anaerobic conditions in response to rainfall events. So now we're really interested in the interactions between rainfall events and carbon availability. So if it's dry enough that you stimulate a burst of respiration, or if the rain events occur during a period when soil carbon availability is high, then you might indeed get hot moments of anaerobic conditions and denitrification in these soils. And so we need to keep working on these and incorporate these into our models and into our annual estimates. We've also been reaching out to the hydropedology community, which is very active at Hubbard Brook, to start to think about in three dimensions. We're pretty good in soil biology at sampling the surface soil. We sample in the field, we bring it into the lab. But a lot of the action, if we think on along slopes where we have variation in bedrock and water table depth, and we can establish these hydropedological sequences at different places in these watersheds, and we can look to see does landscape position matter and do certain horizons within the soil profile matter more. And indeed, when we search for hotspots in three dimensions, we discover that a lot of denitrification potential, a lot of microbial biomass and activity is occurring deep in the soil profile. So if we look at something, this is denitrification potential. How is this distributed among the, there's the OIE horizon, there's an OA horizon, and then there's these mineral soil horizons. There's a significant amount of denitrification going on deep in the soil profile. A significant amount of nitrogen mineralization going along deep in the soil profile. And this is an old story in soils. If we talk to the soil genesis people, they're always going to fuss that we're not sampling deep enough, you know. And I'm sampling now through the crust into the mantle, and they're like, "You must get into the core, lazy biologists." So I think it's something we can't win, but they're right, and that we need to sample deeply. And the other thing that's interesting, a place like Hubbard Brook, is the bottom of the soil profile is changing a lot because. It's raining more, we're getting big stream flow events, and that causes the water table in the near stream zone to rise. And we've been able to apply some dual isotope approach to demonstrate that the areas low in the soil profile are actually carrying out a lot of denitrification. So this is was worked out a long time ago. Denitrification discriminates against heavy isotopes. So if I have a pool of nitrate that's being denitrified, the N15 concentration goes up, and the O18 concentration in the nitrate go up in a 2-to-1 ratio. So if I've got a pool of water, I've got a little pool of nitrate, over time, if there's denitrification, I'm going to get this line where the N15 and the O18 go up in a 2-to-1 ratio. So a postdoc, Sarah Wexler, she chased around after rainfall events. So this is in the middle of the summer at Hubbard Brook. There was a rainfall event, she had a whole series of near-stream wells. And so you had a rainfall event, the stream went up, and the water tables rose not super high into the soil profile, but certainly down into these biologically active B horizons. And over a 3-week period, she tracked changes in N15 and O18, and they fell right out along that denitrification line. So it suggested that indeed there is a lot of denitrification going on deep in the soil profile, but we couldn't do it unless we could think about hydrology and unless we could apply these isotope approaches. Okay, so denitrification. In our work at Hubbard Brook, we've demonstrated that the process is important, and we understand that that we think that it's increasing, and we have some pretty good ideas of how it's changing in response to environmental change, and that's what we're supposed to be doing, at least in some branch of soil biology. How do these important processes change in response to environmental change at realistic scales? And we're making progress. We've got some better methods. I think we're thinking about the landscape better. We have some new tools. And all these advances have come because we're looking up at larger scales. We're looking out to other disciplines, and it's allowing us to make progress within our own discipline. And I argue that the things we struggle with in denitrification, lots of people are struggling with in environmental science. We're all struggling with methods. We're all struggling with scales. And the only way out of these problems is to take multidisciplinary integrative approaches that force us to think across scales. Denitrification, we have lots of good work looking at the genes and the populations that are carrying out denitrification. and we're going from the genes to the globe with a process like this. And again, many of us in environmental science are trying to take the miserable data that we produce and make it available in some format for decision makers in applied science. And that's a challenge in denitrification, goodness knows. But in many areas of environmental science, it's a challenge. So I would argue the last 33 years of progress in soil biology have been great, and the next 33 years are going to be even better. I think we're really poised to be making fundamental contributions to our own discipline, learning more about soil biology, but we have the opportunity to take our expertise and combine that in multi and transdisciplinary contexts, and we're going to contribute to issues that people are interested in invasive species, climate change, water quality, and air quality. And soil biology is going to be a fundamental component of environmental science and global change science and sustainability science. The key to that, though, is keeping the balance between our core down-in expertise, but also the ability to look up and out. And I thank you for your attention.